haven't seen old Hitler for a hell of a time. I haven't seen old Hitler for a hell of a time. I went to France to see what he was doing. When I got there, the fucking place was ruined. Oh, I haven't seen old Hitler for a hell of a time. He must have been buggered by a mine. But if he's the leader of the Deutschland Reader, fuck him, he's a cousin of
Croeso and welcome to Tales for Wales, the pod that never fails to fight your boredom on the beaches, to ram history down your throat on the landing grounds, and never surrender in the eager pursuit of Welsh history and beers. As usual, I'm joined by my first lieutenant, Franks, but not so usually. Yeah, we have a new conscript in today. You might have seen him on your socials, reporting from sporting events across the country. Please give a warm croeso to Luke Davis.
Hello, shall I?
What's happening?
Jack was telling me before in the intro he's working on a voice, so I was really ready to see what it was. Yeah, that was your Churchill, I guess, was it?
I thought I could do landing grounds, you know, that bit. Everything else, not so much. But
you sound more like the guy from Franks. You sound like the guy from the Carry On series. Oh, matron.
Matron. Good morning, matron.
Good morning, doctor.
Good morning, matron. Ah, matron, what can I do for you? What is it, matron?
Well, that guy was based off Churchill, I'm pretty sure. So, yeah. But before this, Frank said, oh, what's your intro? And I said, I'm not going to spoil it, all right, because I've got this absolutely nailed down. So, yeah, I kept just a nice little surprise.
Yeah, thank you. That was lovely. Yes, cheers, Luke. Cheers. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for joining in.
Thanks for having me.
For people who don't know Luke, you're really big on socials and doing like live reporting. And we also did say you're your first hunk on the pod, the most handsome man we've had on the pod. So something for the ladies.
More intimidated to have you on here than we had a couple of girls on the other week. I can't believe it.
Yeah. And now we've got an absolute dish. We got the hunk of the pot. We're about to go. Yeah, we didn't realize we'd be so fawning over you, but.
But
you're more than just a pretty face. Do you want to tell people a little bit about yourself, just in case they don't know much about what you do?
Yeah, of course. Oh, fuck. My beer has just spilt all over the menu of the hotel that I'm in. So that couldn't have been any worse.
The flattery's knocked you off your feet, isn't it? You can't believe it.
Can handle this. I do lots of different stuff. My main thing I do a lot of sporting events at the minute. So I'm the voice of the Scarlets rugby team. I've also done stuff for the Champions League. I've done Wales, kind of the youngster sides, Cardiff City, Glamorgan Cricket, 100, all kinds of things. So yeah, I do a lot of live events in the summertime. I also do quite a lot of presenting. So I've done stuff for local television with ITV, done some stuff for BBC as well, did the Bite Size tour. So yeah, I've been quite lucky to have done a lot of different things. Currently up in North Wales filming, I don't know how much of it I can say, I'm filming a TV show that is probably one of the most weird and dystopian things I've ever seen, but it's for kids. So it's
nice. Yeah. It's deadly mix. Yeah.
Love yeah. That. Well, it's quite weird. Kids... So I'm coming up in Carnarvon. So yeah.
Kids TV, like in the 80s and 90s, was like quite creepy, and I think that was really fun. So I hope they bring a bit of dystopia back to a childhood television.
I mean, yeah, not because obviously in kids TV you also have a lot of alcohol and drugs problems. So hopefully we're not bringing that back into the mix of the kids TV.
I was going to say, I was like, yeah, Watership Down never did me any harm. I stay sitting here supping on a beer. Fine.
Yeah. Well, I remember watching the Demon Headmaster and being fucking terrified of that. I was so scared of him, like, just generally creeped me out so much. And
I came back every week for him, though. Like, yeah. I was scared, but I used to watch it religiously.
Like, Demon Headmaster.
Yeah, absolutely.
Headmaster. Yeah, I remember that. Goosebumps was my favourite. And there was some, if you look back at some of the episodes, some of them are really crap, but some of them are still quite creepy and weird, even for kids.
Yeah.
It was the same as like that Are You Afraid of the Dark? That was on the same sort of level, wasn't it? Where some episodes were like, yeah, completely fine and you can understand it for children. Other episodes were like, holy shit, this is like scary for like an adult, let alone a kid. Why is this airing at like 4 p.m.?
And I even find the Queen's nose a bit scary, but I think I was just a bit of a coward as a kid. I was just always a bit scared of a lot of things going
on. What's scarier than all your dreams coming true, mate, eh?
Yeah.
Think about it.
There was one episode, though. Wasn't there one episode in the Queen's nose where someone's tongue got really long?
Yeah, it was. I remember
bringing
that.
Bringing back some nightmares
then.
Now.
It's like it gets bit, and it's like because it's like not CGI, it just gets like bigger and bigger and bigger. But it's clearly like some kind of like goop or glue. It's fucking terrifying. And
I'm wondering what the wish would have been for that, though.
Well, what's that's the thing with the Queen's the nose; they always fuck you. It's like, oh, here
it's
we
a bit
go.
Of a monkey's paw, isn't it?
Yeah, but in it, she once wanted loads of pasta, and then she was on a boat, and a boat started sinking because she had too much pasta.
Well, you can't put the writing team on it.
Yeah. It was like Friday afternoon in the writing room, and I was like, oh, whatever. Yeah. Too much pasta. Yeah. Print it.
They've just eaten loads of pasta, too full to write. Oh, God, I'm so full. What should the episode be about? Pasta? Rigatoni?
Yeah. So, yeah, too much rigatoni. Was that the name of the episode?
Yeah. Well, I don't know why we went down on a big pasta route. But Luke also does really interesting and really fun, like, listicle videos on Instagram and other socials where you'll do a top five or, like, a top three, mostly.
Listicle, that's a good word.
Yeah, it's a good word, isn't it? It's up there.
On you.
But Luke, you often focus on either history or Welsh things in specific. You're a bit of an ambassador for Cymru. So we reached out and we'd ask if you'd join on, and very kindly you said yes.
Ambassador of a Cymru. I mean, that's a massive compliment. I don't know if I'm more flattered by that or by the gushing at the beginning
dish.
Of the podcast. I'm not quite sure. Yeah. The dish. I'm not going to live this down, like. But yeah, but I do lots of... 2 years ago I started doing it. My agent said, oh, maybe try and get a bit more popular on the socials. And I thought, I don't really want to do OnlyFans. I don't want to do...
but you
like,
could.
Don't really could. As well. You've always had the inkling, but just didn't really want to push
yourself.
You've
got two subscribers right here, man.
Day oneers. Yeah.
Missing out. So I did want to do that. I did want to do like trending dances or like trends. I was like, oh, what about... I want to make something. And I love film. So I thought I'd do something that I enjoy, which is talking about Wales and history. And yeah, I've always loved history since I was a kid. My dad showed me Saving Private Ryan when I was way too young to see it, and I just got like hooked on like World War II. But yeah, I try my best to keep them light and fresh, entertaining. I get a lot of messages from like young people and stuff saying they appreciate learning more about their country, which is really nice. Yeah, it's great.
That's class, man. Yeah, I like as well that you went, I want to keep it light and fresh, unlike Saving Private Ryan. Probably that has something to do with that, like being exposed to D-Day recreation, you know, with that harrowingness of that. You went, let's keep it a little bit lighter than that, actually.
Yeah, but absolutely.
That's kind of what today's episode, we've been doing this now for like 2 years. We've done like 115 episodes or something, and we've never touched World War II. It's crazy. Me and Jack both like enjoy that. So we thought... we'd get you on and we'd go through a listicle, like three facts each about Wales's involvement, Cymru's involvement in the second... No, they don't call it the Great War, do they? That's the First World War.
That's the first one, yeah. I think, isn't it?
Yeah, but they didn't call it the Great War Part 2. It's just World War 2. But we thought we'd find the sequel.
Especially that was the official one. We have now begun Great War Part 2. Official.
In development.
Great War Harder.
Yeah. The difficult second album. But we thought we'd each come with a slightly... not unusual, but like a probably less than your average, you know, maybe less well-known facts about Welsh history. And we thought we'd do one each. And I don't know how we'll start. Luke, as our guest, do you want to go first?
Hang on, you're balls in this up, mate. The whole second half of this entire podcast setup. Yeah. What's everyone drinking?
Very true. Well, Luke, do you want to go first? What are you having?
Yeah, why not? So there's an Asda opposite my hotel, and it does four beers, 4 for 3. So I got a Singer, which is Thai beer. I got an Asahi. I know I listened to one of your podcasts before. I know you boys like really like non-mental lager. You quite like the basic stuff.
Of course.
So I tried, I got a Cruz Campo, an Asahi, a Singer. None of these are that basic, actually. And an old Moot.
Oh, cider. Yeah.
Ooh, so you're doing the cider and lager combo, mixing in the belly. dangerous.
I don't know if I'll do all of them, but I'll see how it goes.
Well, I would say I love her singer. I love Asahi. That's one of mine and Jack's favourite.
I was going to say, all fine selections.
Yeah, when we're being fancy, yeah. When we're moving up from Carlin.
Pushing the boat out, yeah. Yeah. Loving Asahi.
What are you having, Jack?
I'm just on the Bud Light, distinctively not fancy. Bud Light's like for now. I just think you get more bang for your buck with Bud Lights. You can go longer because they're weaker, you know?
Yeah,
there was a time where I was like, oh, they're too weak. Being a knob about drinking. But now these days, it's all about the longevity, isn't it? Have a good time for a long time.
And I was on the Stella, but I've now matured onto a Bartidi and Pepsi Max. So I'm on the run.
Fancy Bartidi.
Oh, wow.
My wife bought me a bottle because it's been a pretty hectic time outside of work and she knows the way to my heart. Rum. Some absolutely delicious
lots
rum.
And lots of rum.
Yeah.
Oh, you're making me feel like a fool now. I've got some Cappy Morgans here, but you've blown me out of the water with the other pirate themed rum.
Well,
Cappy Morgan's
talking
Welsh,
of...
though, so you can ask
me. Yeah. Nothing wrong
with silver, is there? You know, no. It's fine.
Well, I was trying to think of a fun segue to blow me out of the water, but I don't know if anyone's stories about a boat. Has anyone got a story about a boat? If not, we can move on to one.
No. Skip over that one, I think.
Yeah, all right.
Off top of my head, mate. Sorry.
It's a great idea, but we didn't stick the landing on that one.
No.
That's okay.
Oh, landing, D-Day. Right, we're back in.
There we go, we're in.
There we go, yes.
Right. Luke, do you want to pick your first listicle fact?
Oh, go on then. okay, so my first World War II Welsh fact is an example or a story when the Welsh language saved soldiers' lives. So, September 1944, in the Dutch village of Roosel, there was a big scrap between the British and German forces, and this village was really strategically important, and it was quite a key route to advance further east. So, in the end, there's quite a lot of deaths: 145 British, 500 German, and 21 civilians. Oof. This battle was a pretty big deal, and the Royal Welsh Fusiliers were there trying to start this stuff when they accidentally got kind of stuck in a church right in the middle of town by German machine gunners. They were pinned down by German machine gunners, and newspaper reports from the time say that the men were trying to convey message back and forth, and they switched the Welsh language, knowing that the Germans wouldn't have a clue what they were on about. And what they did, they told each other to wait till nightfall so they can leave without alerting the enemy, and to retreat slowly, like in, I guess, like the end of Great Escape, and they were all kind of running out, kind of going in twos and threes. And they had this really cool system where they were just chucking back and forth instructions in Welsh. And so much so that when the town was liberated in 1944, loads of village had been destroyed, and there was actually people, images of Welsh families laying wreaths for the graves of kind of fallen soldiers and stuff. So, yeah, so Roosel has a quite big connection to Wales.
That's pretty sick. I always thought, like, I got one about the Welsh language on this later on, and I know it's kind actually, I'll come to it in a little bit, but I was trying to research if Welsh was used much in the war, and I couldn't find that. So that's a banging one. That's a great start.
Straight out of the box.
Yeah, there's the only other example I could find of Welsh language in the war was the Battle of Donbike in Burma, and that was the Welsh Fusiliers again. And this is a really quick thing to add on as well. So the Japanese had English-speaking soldiers, which they used to send psychological warfare messages to the troops. But the broadcaster, the RAF soldiers, switched to Welsh to ensure that their communications would completely confuse the Japanese, basically. So Welsh being not that much of a big language, actually, you could argue, has its advantages too, in a weird way.
I love that, Just try learning Welsh with your Japanese soldiers. Yeah, try and do it. It's one of the hardest languages to learn as an adult, I've heard. So give that a go.
I know they did do that, because my granddad, when he was in the war, he was actually told to learn Welsh because he didn't speak Welsh fluently. Where he was fighting, he was in the tanks, and he used to say that he used to talk to each other on the radios back and forth in Welsh as well then, like the Native Americans did. I think they're called the Wind Talkers. They did something similar in America where they'd use Native American soldiers to speak their languages because no one could dissect it.
Well.
I mean, people doing it here. I mean, Carnarvon, people are doing it all the time. I'm walking into pubs and speaking Welsh instantly, so they know, he's a Welsh speaker. We can't just turn around and
Yeah. Slag him off, yeah.
Well, I'm not slagging off.
That age-old boogeyman, isn't it, that you hear sometimes when English people are like, oh, they're definitely talking about me. Well, they were talking about me until I came in. It's like, no, mate, don't worry. You weren't in, so how would we be talking about you? Yeah. Think about it.
Yeah. I also like that one, because how would you know if they weren't speaking Welsh before we came in if you weren't already in there? Because they always say, oh, they were speaking English before I turned in. So how would you know you weren't there?
We could talk about this all night, mate. We could talk about it all night.
All right, Jack,
can I go next? Because I've got I've got a nice segue in there. Because what Luke was just saying then about the Royal Welsh. Mm. So this is more of a slight story, sorry. It's not a quick fact. Mm. Basically, I found a little tidbit about the Welsh Fusiliers.
What is a fusilier? Does anyone...
It's a general purpose. I looked it up for this, actually. Yeah. It's like a general purpose collection of troops. So they can have many different specializations. At least that's what I read anyway. And that was the first Google link. And that's what I'm sticking with. This was, like I said, the nice little segue into this. Because I read about the Welsh Regiment and their role in the Battle of Cohima and the Siege of Imphal in 1944. So the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, sorry, I'm going to mess that word up a lot.
Yeah, we were not all trained professionals like Luke.
Yes, so exactly. We'll
be dribbling our words out.
So the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, it was an infantry regiment that pulled its recruits mainly from North Wales. The Royal Welsh Fusiliers, Jesus Christ, this is going to be a struggle. They spell Welsh, by the way, W-E-L-C-H.
Welch.
Yeah. I looked into why this was, and it's just the old English way of spelling Welsh, essentially. Yeah. And they've had that spelling since like back in Napoleonic times. Mm. So they kept that spelling until like 2006, where they merged with the Royal Welsh SH at the end. Yeah. And now that CH version doesn't exist anymore. Anyway, so part of the Yugo offensive. Japan was aiming to invade India through Burma to cut off Allied supply lines. The goal was to capture the city of Imphal, the British supply hub, and block reinforcements from reaching it by taking Cohima to the north. This would effectively trap British forces in Imphal, forcing their surrender. Also, just a side note, I couldn't read that the name of that offensive, the Yugo offensive, without thinking of that How Can She Slap video.
Why?
With the Yugo, you know, because he goes... Why didn't you go and fuck off then? And he goes, you go. I think gets fucking nailed. Anyone remember that from the 2000s? No? Niche reference?
Not at all.
Oh my God. How do you not remember that? I can't be alone in this.
We'll edit into this if it's...
Come on, listeners. Please, God, chime in. Because that is... That can't... I thought that was like a cultural revolution. That was like the most... The first thing I can think of is like an example of a viral video. And I'm getting absolute crickets.
When you said... When you said, oh, when I heard you go, all I could think of, I was like, where's he going with this?
You must remember that. How can she slap Hugo? I know just saying it again and again isn't going to make you know, but
I can't even imagine the video of a head what that would look like. What is it like? No, right. A girl gets slapped.
No, it's the girl slaps the guy because, oh, I'll tell you what, I'll send you the link after this. All right, okay. We'll sort this out like men later. It's fine. Anyway, back to my story. That was
that
a sick
another case
reference
of you
really
like,
about
saying
that.
Something that's not appropriate when that's getting confused. So is this just a thing we don't
know? No, it was a thing that like, I everyone knows about it. Well, evidently not everyone, but right, I'm getting a tiz now. Really. Upset me by not getting that reference.
Sorry.
But I'll send you the links afterwards, right?
All right.
Anyway, back to the World War II shenanigans instead of my stupid, apparently niche video.
Anyway, go on.
2000. Oh, I see what you did there.
I missed that.
Very good. Kick me while I'm down, why don't you? Anyway, so just to get back to the brutality of World War II, this Battle of Cohima was, in 2013, was voted Britain's greatest battle in a poll run by the National Army Museum, and has been described as the Stalingrad of the East because of how bloody a struggle it was. So to set the stage a bit, the Japanese attacked Cohima in early April 1944. They intended to cut off supplies and reinforcements heading to Imphal. Meanwhile, three other Japanese divisions surrounded Imphal itself, attacking the 60,000 Allied forces stationed there, and began the siege, what was known as the Siege of Imphal. Now, for our Welsh lads' involvement, the siege was a real bloody affair, but the Allied troops were just about holding out. With time of the essence, the 2nd Battalion Welsh Fusiliers I nailed it that time, joined up with the 161st Indian Infantry Brigade and marched to reinforce the defenders of Imphal and break the siege. They had to trek through the Naga Hills, fighting off skirmishes as they travelled, but eventually reached Imphal and broke the siege, driving the Japanese back. The Royal Welsh were then tasked with cleaning out the remaining Japanese forces in the surrounding hills, but the Japanese were dug in really deep, holding defensive positions in terrace gardens, bunkers, jungle-covered ridges, all that sort of stuff. It's made the task a really like slow and bloody affair. The Royal Welsh were eventually forced to fight the Japanese in close quarters in brutal trench-to-trench combat. Kohima and Imphal are apparently battles known for their large-scale use of bayonets, knives, and hand-to-hand combat. That's the sort of level of like brutality we're sort of talking about. This was the same for other Allied forces in the area as well. One example is that there was a tennis court in Kohima that had Japanese and Allied trenches literally just a few feet from each other. So people are just like poking bayonets across, throwing grenades. It's like really like dog eat dog sort of stuff. Yeah. The battle was described as a war of inches. And then by June 1944, the Japanese were suffering from starvation and disease after a long fight. And as well as increasing losses at the hands of the Allies, they decided to retreat eventually. The Royal Welsh, along with other British forces, were charged with pursuing them, inflicting even more losses on the Japanese as they fled to Burma. So all in all, the fighting in Kohima and Imphal led to 37,000 dead British and Indian troops and over 50,000 Japanese soldiers dead. The successful defence and counterattack at Kohima prevented Japan from invading India and marked a major turning point in the Burma campaign. The Royal Welsh Fusiliers were praised for their determination and endurance, fighting in dense jungle and mountainous terrain under extreme conditions. And the regiment kept fighting in the area as well as in Burma until Japan was eventually defeated in the region. So I'd never once heard, I'm not a huge World War II history buff, but the fact that the Welsh element were involved in such a like a bloody struggle, I'd never heard about that. So I thought it was worth saying.
That's insane. And I really find World War II fascinating, and that's just like, that's insane, because you often also think of the, you know, in the Eastern Theatre, you often just think of it as being like America's war, like them being in Okinawa and stuff. And, you 100%. Know, what you kind of have in your mind, you don't think of any Welsh people being there. That's nuts.
Yeah.
There's so much of it focused on Europe, isn't there? Like you said, that you just think it's the Americans that are over in the kind of East doing everything.
Also, but, you know, when people try and do Welsh accents, they often do Indian accents. Do you reckon when they got there, they just thought everyone sounded the same? Like the Welsh and the Indian blokes just sounded like each other?
So many Welsh blokes around, they were thinking like...
Yeah. It would have made a weird equilibrium where the accent would have just merged into the same accent.
Yeah.
So
the English guys were just feeling back with the super outnumbered. Yeah.
All right, so my one is... I tried to get quite varied ones, but my first one is about the Women's Land Army in Wales. And this is what, like, I think a lot of us know this, don't we? Like before the Second World War, women's rights and their place in society was, treated quite harshly and unequal compared to what it is like today. And the war in part was a reason why their status got improved, because they, before the war, they were generally not really thought to be able to work unless they were single or didn't have a family. So it wasn't often acceptable for women to work outside of the home unless they, like I said, unless they were single and they didn't have a family to look after. But with the men conscripted into the armed forces, this change and the Women's Land Army played a crucial role in keeping Welsh agriculture running. So the lives of many women changed completely during the Second World War. And for the first time, many of them left home to work. In 1939, around 100,000 women in Wales worked, but by 1944, the number doubled to 200,000. As Britain needed to be self-sufficient and farmers were required to produce more food than ever before, they had to look for more people to work on farms, and many farmhands had gone off to the war. So then the government proposed this propaganda to try and persuade people to live in a way which would help the war efforts. So they produced these like propaganda things that, you know, for years they've been saying women don't belong in the workplace, and now they had to completely do a massive U-turn, which kind of... like it would have looked pretty like suspicious like a couple of years beforehand, you're saying, you know, stay home and look after, and now they've got this I was looking at some of the fucking maddest propaganda posters. They've got one of like a ghostly Hitler leaning over a lady sat by a tree with her children, where he shouts, take them back like three times, and then the copy underneath says, don't do it, mother, leave the children where they are. It just says that. So it's like it was used to persuade women to let the kids stay in the countryside as evacuees, but they just had all this mad propaganda to try and convince women not to go back to their kids. But by 1943, almost 5,000 women were part of the Wales Land Army in specific areas of West Wales. And they'd never really worked on a farm before. These people had come from like South Wales or places where farming wasn't as big. And they were aged between like 18 and 40. And they were encouraged to join because they were kind of told that these jobs would be a bit more like comforting and fashionable. It was just the same propaganda they used against the men. But it was when they actually got there, it was, you know, incredibly tough work they had to do. They had to adjust to these new lives in the Land Army. Their recruitment posters were like these really fashionable women having a great time. But when they got there, it was quite lonely. It was incredibly difficult. They were kind of hoodwinked.
It's a breeze. It's just a wee gals, basically. Yeah.
And if you think of like how immensely difficult farming is, imagine being a beginner with no like experience whatsoever. And now you're told to grow crops, cultivate the land, look after the animals. You had like zero experience. You were hastily prepared to get there. And
I've never seen a pig before.
And then whilst he did get there, the people who'd stayed still were, like the men and families who'd stayed behind were quite judgmental of you for being a woman working. So it was like a bit of a, you can't win, you can't lose, you know, it's a lose-lose situation. But the Women's Land Army, they helped prevent food shortages and they changed the perception of women's capabilities, especially in parts of Wales where it was still seen as quite like almost ungodly for women to be working. Many land girls, like they formed lasting friendships after this, but they weren't massively recognised even when men came back from the war. And it wasn't until 2008 that they actually it was the first time they were recognised as veterans. So it was like for a long time, these women were the main reason people had food and the Britain back home was still working, but they weren't really given any kind of recognition for it whatsoever. And it wasn't until like I said, 2008, the first one's got a commemorative badge to say, good on you, girls. So it's a bit like, 50 years too late. But yeah, so life was really tough, long hours, poor pay, and basic accommodation was like the only thing you'd really get from it. But it's a story that it's not massively told. And I know it's quite fun to focus on the upfront war and the blood and guts of it. I just thought my first one would be a homage. Yeah.
Won't
to the
you
women
think of the gals back home for God's sake?
Yeah.
That's mad. Like, how sexist are we going to be there? Imagine the whole nation is literally starving. Like, oh, where's the farmers gone? Oh, they're all in Normandy. Oh, get the women. No. I don't want my potatoes grown by a bloody woman.
Like, exactly. It's ridiculous.
The nation's on its knees. Like,
you could totally imagine some old codgers, can't you? Was this potato grown by a woman or a man? Because I swear to God.
I don't know. I was just reading around. I thought that's mental. That like you've got the literal Nazis across the water from you, and you're pissed off
knocking on the door. Yeah,
country's gone to the dogs. Oh well. Yeah. All right, Luke. Do you want to do your second?
Absolutely. You spoke of blood and guts there, from some blood and guts to more blood and guts. I'm going to talk about Operation Mincemeat, which is a bit of an obvious one. There's a Netflix film about it. A lot of people may know this one, some people may not.
I don't actually, I don't know anything about it.
Do you know?
No.
Watched it with the missus the other day, actually. Very good. But no spoilers. Yeah. I'll let you do it.
All right, mate. Thank you. So, Operation Mincemeat. This was in 1943. So the war was just starting to turn. We just had the Allies just had a good campaign in North Africa. I wasn't there. I wasn't even live yet. So they had a good campaign
reported
in North
live.
Africa. Yeah. yeah, exactly. And the Allies were just about to prepare to invade Sicily and to go into Italy to basically take out Mussolini and just get Italy back. But they needed to mislead the Germans into thinking that they weren't going to come into Sicily and that they were going to be attacking Greece or Sardinia instead. And this is absolutely crucial because in the landing, they didn't want to have any kind of machine guns and kind of actual positions there. So they didn't want to have the Germans prepared for when they rocked up. So what they did, they used a corpse to carry fake documents to fool the Nazi high command. So what happened was they used the body of a dead Welshman, Glyndŵr Michael, who was a homeless Glyndŵr Michael, a homeless man from Aberbargoed. He died in London after ingesting rat poisoning. So what they did, they had this corpse and they dressed Glyndŵr Michael as a Royal Marine officer and gave him the false name Major William Martin and made loads of kind of fake letters and correspondence and documents suggesting that an Allied invasion was going to happen in Greece. to kind of put the Germans off. And the so they did in April 1943, the German intelligence, British intelligence, they released the body off the coast of Spain, where they knew it would be picked up by Spanish locals. It was found by local Spanish fishermen. And because at the time Italy, it wasn't supporting Germany, but you could argue there was some Spanish sympathy towards Germany. Yeah. Not a puppet state as such, but it was a little bit, you know, they had a bit of a closer affinity to the Germans than they did to the British. And to reinforce how much of a problem this was, the British diplomats in Spain, they pretended to panic and be like, oh my God, this body, there's so many documents on it, blah, 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 knowing the Germans would have picked this up. So what they also did, the British, to ensure that the documents within Glyndwr Michael's corpse had been read, they planted a single black eyelash inside one of the envelopes. So when the body was to be returned back with the documents from Spain, they could open the letter and see if the eyelash was missing or not, knowing if the Germans had seen it. The eyelash was missing, which made the Allies believe that the Germans had read the letter, and they had, and Hitler and his generals got the correspondence, took the bait, and moved all their critical divisions away from Sicily and over to Greece. The Allies then invaded Sicily, and the Germans were completely caught off guard, which is absolutely insane.
Mugged them off. Absolutely mugged them off.
Glyndwr Michael, how good would you be that when you were alive, you couldn't get a job, and then you die and beat Hitler?
So that's the Welsh story, mate. That's the absolute Welsh story. 101. I like that as well. That feels like something a suspicious girlfriend would do. Is like putting an eyelash in a paper to see if you've moved it. It's like like a really
No. I never read it, love. I never read it. Well, where's the eyelash?
Where's the eyelash?
Shit!
Don't lie to me. But the film is also really good. It's with Colin Farrell. Is it Colin Farrell? Yeah, it is Colin Farrell.
And Michael McFadden, is it? The guy who plays Tom in Succession. He's in it as well.
Yeah.
There's a few people. You recognise quite a few people in it. Like, it's like a who's who of like British character actors, you know?
Yeah.
But it's, it was a good film. I liked it as well. It was very interesting. And again, another thing, the boy whose body was sort of sacrificed for the scheme. Yeah, Glyndwr Michael. That's a great first name.
Do they mention him in the film?
Yes, they do actually, and their pronunciation is pretty good, but they don't roll. It's a bit like Glyndwr. It's not like Glyndwr, but they do say Glyndwr Michael in it a few times.
And they, I was impressed they didn't the just do Glyndwr. Glyndwr or something.
Yeah, I was expecting
that. So the fact they don't trill their R's, I'll let them off for that.
Jack, do you want to do your next one?
Yeah, so I'll give you guys a choice. Do you want another bloody one that's like sort of action-packed, or more sort of logistics for World War Two?
Hit us with a bloody. I don't know. Do you want to? We'll go out with a bloody fact, shall we?
We'll go out with a bloody fact. All right, I'll hit with a logisty. Yeah. Right. So this one is sort of reminiscent of what you were saying, Franks, in that, like, you know, while all the boys were over in Europe fighting the war, someone had to look after the stuff going on at home.
Yeah.
And this was something I found called the Bevin Boys Scheme. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that. I had to do some digging for this because Frank sent over the list of what you were doing, Luke, and what he was doing. And I was like, you've absolutely picked all the juicy morsels. So like, I have to go fucking lower than like my fifth Google result now to try and find something. But I found this anyway, this came up Trump. So the Bevin Boys Scheme. So, output from the mines, approaching World War II, had increased all over the world since the Great Depression. But by the time of September 1939 rolled around and the war began, everyone was running at a deficit, or lots of countries were running at a deficit, especially those fighting in the war. And at the start of the war, the government massively underestimated the value of like young, fit miners. And so, like almost every other young lad at the time, they were conscripted into the armed forces. And by mid-1943, the UK was down 36,000 capable coal miners. Mm. Bear in mind, these vacancies also weren't being replaced, because any young guy coming of age was might have been heading for the mines was drafted into the war. Yeah. So there's a massive shortage of like actual capable miners. It was only like sort of the old mining dogs left, basically. Around that time, there was loads of strikes and stuff as well going on around the time about wages and things like that. So the UK was really struggling to power their war effort, as well as like keep people warm at home through the winter and things like that. a guy named Ernest Bevin, a Labour politician who was Minister of Labour and National Service at the time. He made a broadcast appealing to former miners to volunteer for the pits and also issued a standstill order preventing any more miners from being called up to serve in armed forces. He made another radio broadcast on the 12th of November 1943 aimed at sixth form boys, encouraging them to voluntarily work in the mines when they registered for national service. He promised the students, like all those serving at the time, they would be eligible for the government's further education scheme once the war was over. This broadcast is supposedly where the term Bevin Boys came from. Mm. So he actually started up the Bevin Boys scheme. It ran from 1943 to 1945. During that period, one of every 10 men that was called up to fight in the war was sent to work in the mines across the UK. A huge amount, as you can imagine, were sent into Wales because of our proclivity for mines. A lot of these lads weren't very happy with this, thinking working in the mines wasn't contributing as much as like physically fighting in Europe. I mean, to be honest, it's a bit of a Sophie's choice, isn't it? Do you want to go fucking slog your guts out in a mine all day, or go on the front lines in the war in Europe? You know, it's a bit of a tough one. Anyway, in order to make the process random, one of Bevin's secretaries each week from 14th of December 1943 would pull a number from a hat. The hat would have the digits 0 to 9 in it, and all men liable for conscription that week whose national service number ended in that digit were sent to the mines instead. So it's completely random. The only exceptions were if you were highly specialized, like if you were already a pilot or something, or you were like physically unable to work as a miner, you could you know, get out of it. The people selected as well could be from any background at all, and a lot of people took issue with this because some of them were from what you call like higher paying jobs, you know, like clerks and things like that. And they might have like, well, gone, if they'd gone into the army, they'd have been commissioned as officers. Mm-hmm. But instead they were forced to work down in the mines. So, so the Bevin boys, they were given 6 weeks training before being sent underground. There they'd have 4 weeks being supervised by an experienced miner. New miners would essentially be like assistants, so like lots of carrying things, loading up carts, etc. They weren't like physically smashing into like coal veins or anything. They weren't allowed to do that until they'd been there at least 4 months. The only place that this wasn't the case was Wales, where after your 4 weeks supervision, you had to just get in with the big boys, basically, the experienced miners, and start smashing up the coal face. I couldn't find a reason why that was, so I'm just going to chalk it up to the English being nasty to us again. but as if working in the mines wasn't bad enough, Bevin boys would also, similar to what you were saying, Franks, about the Women's Land Army, Bevin boys would often be taunted and judged for being draft dodgers, and they were also often called conchies, which was apparently a word for conscientious objectors, the people that refused to fight in the war, because Bevin boys, they didn't wear any uniforms or any identifying markers, so when people saw like a young fit lad walking around, why aren't you in the war sort of thing, they assume you're ducking out of your duty.
That's mad.
And there was also a totally different independent scheme going on at the same time, where conscientious objectors, they were finding ways for them to serve their country elsewhere other than fighting. So they would one of these schemes was to send them into the mines as well. So they kind of got lumped together as far as the British public were concerned.
Wow.
After the war ended, the Bevin boys weren't given any medals or allowed to return to their old jobs. They did get to do the further education scheme as promised. This is where like the government paid for your tuition and some living expenses for higher education and stuff like that. And then on the 20th of June 2007, it wasn't until then, Prime Minister Tony Blair said that all previous mining conscripts would be awarded the Veterans Badge Medal. And these were dished out then in 2008 by his replacement, Gordon Brown, marking the 60th anniversary of the discharge of the last Bevin boy.
So that'd be the same year the Women's Land Army got their recognition as well, 2008.
Ah, must have tied it all up together, yeah. There's actually a memorial to the Bevin boys you can see today. It's at the National Memorial Arboretum in, I don't know if I say this well, Alrawas in Staffordshire. It was erected on the 7th of May 2013, and it's made of grey Kilkenny stone from Ireland that apparently turns into a deep black over time, meant to resemble the coal that all the miners dug out. But yeah, that was the Bevin boys. I'd never heard of those. So another like sort of keeping the fires going at home type job.
Is that linked to an Iron Bevin by any chance?
I was
it Bevin who started?
No, it's a different spelling of Bevan. It's Bevin, B-I-I-N at the end. And like I said, it's from this guy called Ernest Bevin. He's like a Labour politician.
I do like the ones where you kind of focus on those who didn't get the recognition at the time as well, because, it must have been really fucking annoying if you were slogging your guts up underground and then they come back and they call you like a work shy, like coward.
Especially as it's not even like your choice, it's a randomly selected thing. And like a lot of these boys apparently would have preferred to have been shipped off to like France or somewhere in Europe. But then to slog your guts, like I said, I doubt they're doing 8-hour shifts with an hour lunch back then either. They're probably fucking going from sun up to sundown. And then, for someone to be like, you're an absolute conchie.
Yeah.
All right. My grandfather used to say that word, apparently. He was he fought in the war. So my dad had me quite late. My grandfather was in Normandy stuff. And he apparently would say, bloody conchies. He also had next-door neighbours who were, I'm not saying this is okay, next-door neighbours who were Italian. And my grandfather didn't have much respect to Italians after the war, for obvious reasons, because we fought against them. And he would do this thing where he would wake them up every morning with a fire poker hitting the wall. Just battering the wall, go, bloody Italians. My dad's like, Dad, what are you doing? He's like, oh, bloody Italians. I'm like, what the fuck? Anyway, sorry.
I love that, the pettiness of it. Right, you're going to be up early at the crack of dawn every morning.
But like
so petty.
My granddad went over really young, and he lied about his age when he went over there the first time. And then the boys he was going with, the miners he was going with, he was only 16. They told the officers when they got to France, and he got arrested and sent back home. And then it's mad to think that they're actively choosing to go to war. I'd be like, what are you mad? I'm staying at home. Oh, I'll play Xbox. There's no chance.
The fact that people back then, lads back then were like, 16 going, oh, I'm 18, please take me to war. It really makes me realise how fucking work shy I am. Jesus.
I actually felt this is such a weird thing, because conscription is normally 18 to 30, right? The feeling of like bliss I had is if you go to war with Russia, I'm now 31. It's like, boys, I love the fight, boys, but I just,
It's funny you said 34, that. Can't do it, can't go
I
anymore.
Didn't realise the age, because I thought it was much older, and I was like, oh, fuck's sake, I'm going to have to get in better nick if I'm off to go fight the Ruskies. I was generally thinking
this other day. Submitting my official paperwork, I'll be saying I'm a 16-year-old lad, you can't draft me.
Yeah. Well, I didn't realise it was 18 to 30, that feels a bit young. I bet they'll raise it, when we have to go to war, they'll raise it.
Oh, it's like bloody retirement, isn't it? They'll screw us over with that as well. Like, it's up to 40 now. I'm like, oh, I'm just shy. Come on. Six more years, I'll be all right.
Well, my one is about, my next one's about those who got captured in the war. So I'm doing German prisoners of war camps in Wales. And so if you don't know, obviously Wales, not obviously, Wales served as a place to house a lot of prisoners of war, those being German or Italian soldiers. During World War II, it held like several infamous prisoner of war camps. These camps,
every morning they were subjected to torture. Someone was banging with a fire.
Someone came with a fire poker daily.
Waking up crack of dawn every morning.
These camps they varied in size and function, from like large purpose built compounds to repurposed stately homes and things that they could just find to stick people in, and then like work camps where prisoners could be like farm labourers. The type of camps they had specifically in Wales, though, they had these internment camps, which is pretty grim. These are the ones where before like the war, just as the war was happening, they would round up they called them enemy aliens, which meant anyone like who was German or Italian living in Britain.
Nice name, isn't it?
I know, but that meant they like, like you'd call a person who was not from that country an illegal immigrant, no, an illegal alien. It's the same here as an enemy alien, so a foreign person who they class an enemy. So you could be completely innocent.
I'm assuming you were going to say, and there was actually an undocumented alien invasion at the time, and Wales had to step up.
Really right wing and racist.
Independence Day style, and just fucking bring it together.
Oh, right, you meant actual aliens.
Actual aliens,
So they would just round up anybody who was German or Italian, and they'd get arrested and put into these camps. Without a trial, they were just deemed to be too much of a risk to the state, so they were locked up. And then during the war, towards the end of the war, after the North Africa campaign in 1942-43 and after the D-Day landings in 44, a huge number of Axis prisoners, so that's the people who, so if, just in case you're not too sure about the terms here, allies were the Americans, the British, the French, the Indians, the Canadians, etc. And the Axis were the baddies. It's the Japanese, it's the Italians, So the number of these prisoners skyrocketed after these campaigns. So they had to get more and more of these camps set up. And then whilst they're at the camps, they'd have to be set to work on forests, you know, farms, all that stuff, like I mentioned. But there were some really notable ones in Wales. There's one that's turned into a museum now called Island Farm, called Camp 198 in Bridgend. And it's this infamous... Do you know about this one? I had never heard of it before.
Said the camp number. I've no idea. Yeah, but keep going. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Well, so there's two reasons it's famous. There was a great escape there. There's the German Great Escape. And afterwards, it held high-ranking German officers, including General Blumentritt, who was a key planner of the Blitzkrieg strategy. And I'll talk about why they were held there in a second. But first of all, they had this great escape in 1947. It was soon after their arrival. When these German soldiers first got put into Island Farm, they instantly started to plan their escape. So they dug these two tunnels in the camp. So they discovered the first one in January 1945. But they didn't escape the second one until the 10th of March 1945. So what's that, 3 months later? And in that time then, 70 prisoners escaped through the tunnel dug at Hut 9, which is now the only hut left standing. So when you go there, you can still visit the hut that they did this from. The tunnel was 30 feet long and it breached the perimeter fence. Some of the techniques used in the by these inmates were like deemed as like ingenious, and they were part of the... scenes shown in The Great Escape, which is the Allied version.
Why didn't the guards should have just watched The Great Escape and then they'd have been clued up, wouldn't they?
Well, the stuff they do is really cool, man. It's they were excavating the tunnels, and it was really hard because they were made of heavy clay soil.
Sympathising with Nazis. I mean, didn't think that was what a podcast was about, but all right.
Well, also, just remember, not all German soldiers were Nazis, so these could have just been salt of the earth. I don't know why I'm defending the Germans, but...
say, awfully quick to jump to their defence,
The excavating the tunnels was really not easy because they had these heavy clay soil which the camp was built on, so they had to use cans, meat tins, and even knives they stole from the canteen to dig their way through this soil, and then they hauled it back out of the tunnel in makeshift skips and put them into kit bags. At first, the prisoners carried the soil in their pockets to the long jump or dropped them in the garden pots, but there just became too much of it. So then they started to roll it up into like little kneaded balls of clay, and they dropped them through a hole in the false wall they'd built. So like in the where they were in their like what they're called, like terraces or the camps they were staying in, they had these little false walls where they built a tiny little hole through, and they used to stick all their clay down there at the end of the day. And then to support the tunnel roof, they stole benches and replaced them from the canteen and bed legs and any kind of like wood they could find that wasn't completely strapped down or would be noticeable if you went missing. They also built a ventilation pipe that was made from condensed milk tins. Air was forced through by hand, but with a hand-operated fan. So they built these condensed milk tins, and they had these little hand-operated fans so they'd be able to tunnel them. Because obviously, you're in the dark, it's no breathing, and it could collapse on you.
You need some circulation, don't you?
Yeah. But they were so like ingenious, they even built these own electric lights, which tapped to the main supply. And then they concealed their...
the Lecky bill through the roof. What's going on?
That part's a bit mad. It's like, well, that seems like one step too far. But you know, the Germans, they're obsessed with engineering. But all this is like really quite loud and noticeable. So they decided that they would pretend they were really into singing. So they had, and especially because here in Wales, that went down a tree. So they decided to create their own choir. So they had this choir and they were singing every night. And they'd worked
all the local Welsh lads going, I get it. They all want to just have a sing song.
Apparently, they really liked it. So the guards would come out and watch them sing. And then the Germans there would have like an actual choir whilst they were digging in the background. And before they planned the escape, the escapees were divided into groups. Each of one was equipped with a map they'd made and a homemade compass, plus some rations. And then each person in the group also had identity papers produced in the camps. They made these fake papers in the camp in case they were caught.
Jesus.
And all these preparations required tremendous organization, but it's not known exactly how they did it or if there's any like internal help or any sympathizers. But for security purposes, each escapee's identity was only known to the others in a small group. So like if they were in their small group and they were captured, they could only dob themselves in. They couldn't do it.
So they did the compartmentalization type thing.
But around 10 p.m. on March the 10th, the prisoners made their move. A few stole the local doctor's car and got as far as Birmingham, which is 120 miles away. Another group got to the port of Southampton. The prisoners knew their way around through a crude but accurate drawing of Wales that they'd done, mostly because they knew where all the rail lines were and principal roads.
So they managed to redraw
it by like memory, which is really impressive. Again, sympathising with the Germans an awful lot here.
That's the most German thing ever, by the way.
Yeah.
We don't remember anything, just the train stations, that's where we'll go.
Also, whenever I say clever boys, what I meant to say was devious, all right? When you're Germans, you're devious. You're not clever, you're devious.
So there's this book by Peter Phillips called The German Great Escape, where they said that it was actually 84 prisoners who escaped, eclipsing the 76 allies who broke out of Stalag Luft, you know, from the Great Escape.
You can't say that, though, can you?
Well, that's what the government thought. So 14 were captured really quickly, allowing officials to actually announce for propaganda reasons that only 70 escaped, because it looks better.
Fudging the numbers.
Really, it was 84. And also,
that's
the government
sore
said,
loser tactics, isn't it? We beat you, actually.
Well, the government said that they were all eventually recaptured, although this is disputed, and they actually think three escapees who were spotted in Kent were never caught. So they do think that three got away. And then after the war, this same camp held Nazis waiting trial for the Nuremberg trials. So most of the senior Nazis who were closely related and associated with Hitler were all based in South Wales ahead of the Nuremberg trials, which is pretty cool.
I wouldn't have popped them in there if I were them, because you've already lost a few. So it seems a bit like a risk.
And then just quickly, some other ones. Henshan Camp in Denbighshire, that initially was used for Italian prisoners. And many of the prisoners worked on local farms and then settled there after the war, which I'll chat about in a second as well. Llan Martin Camp, Newport, again, housed a lot of Italian POWs after the North Africa campaign. And most people, except for Luke's grandparents and family, Italians were generally seen as less of a threat and had more freedoms. So they were allowed to get around and do things. They could avoid the fire poker.
Yeah, everything's lovely and hospitable. Meanwhile, my grandfather goes past, bloody Italians!
And then there's one in Cadwent. Again, it was a large site that eventually became a full-time British Army training ground after the war. But part of the legacy was, like, by 1946, thousands of the prisoners who worked on Welsh farms were welcomed by the local community, and they even stayed and married the local women, which is why, especially in Rhondda and parts of South Wales, there's a lot of, like, Italian restaurants, Italian cafes, and Italian ice cream parlours and stuff that all have genuine Italian heritage, because, lots of the members stayed there. So Triorchi, for example, has, like, a whole bunch of Italian cafes, and they're all from ex-prisoners of war. That's my prisoner of war chat. Luke, do you want to do your final
what a chat
one?
It was.
Yeah, of course. Am I okay to open up a quick beer really quickly?
Go wild, go hog wild, mate.
Give me a second.
Please. Were you worried we go, you're taking the fucking piss here, mate? You've overstayed.
Okay, so is that loud?
No. I just love your dedication. So I've got a bottle opener. Smack it against the surface. Don't worry, it'll work. I'll get my beer by hook or by crook.
I use my glasses case to hit the top on a chair.
Wow.
That's how I did it.
You sound like a German prisoner of war.
I was about to say, never mind the ingenuity of the Germans. What about the Welsh? When are we hearing about that?
Yeah, when a Welshman needs a beer.
There's nothing stopping him.
Create an accurate map of a country we've ever been to before with just railway stations. Meanwhile, in Wales.
What the listeners can't see is you've gone around, you've like cranked a winch. There's like a handmade fan that's like a Home Alone-esque type thing. It's just like a brick's just knocked a beer top off.
Speaking of ingenuity, I can't segue this. Yeah, so there was a Nazi plan for Wales, believe it or not. So yeah, the Germans did think about Wales if they were going to invade in 1940. So at this time, Germany were really, I guess, doing the round. So they'd taken Poland, the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Norway, France. The next logical step was Great Britain. So the Nazis prepared, you've probably heard of this, Operation Sea Lion, which was their invasion, or their plans for invasion into Britain to bring Britain to an end and for us to become a puppet state like France. So this obviously never happened because we won the Battle of Britain, and they then turned their attention to Russia and Operation Barbarossa. But there were documents that were written up and that looked at what it would have looked like if the Nazis would have invaded. And these plans came into Allied hands in 1945 at the end of the war. And these Nazi plans were made public after that. So these were some of the things that were, I read in one article, which would happen to Wales if, you know, basically if Germany would have won and taken Britain. So
I'm quite flattered, actually, that they thought of us specifically, that there was something for Wales, not just like, you know, lumping us up with England like a lot of people do. I'm quite flattered that they were like, oh, Wales is its own nation. Oh, cheers, Germany. Cheers, Adolf.
I know.
Maybe he's not so bad after all.
You know what? He got a couple of good points.
Yeah, it's like the ultimate shout out, you know, like the biggest war machine's ever happened. It's like, Wales is mentioned, not chef fights. Yeah. We're getting invaded.
That's how stupidly national, like, proud I'm of Wales. That act like it when the world's worst man ever said something. Yeah. Oh, nice one.
That's it, yeah. Someone's dogging out Hitler, and you go, hang on a minute. He knew that Wales was on the Principality. It was his own country. Okay.
Well, apparently, they were a massive fan of Wales, but they did, they planned that nearly a quarter of Wales' male population. So all abled men in these plans, aged 17 to 45. So we would have made that conscription, unfortunately. Would have been rounded up and sent to continental Europe, or to be served as kind of forced labor, or to be conscripted into the German war machine, which, seeing that, like, German soldiers with Welsh accents, I think would have been absolutely hilarious. In some, you know what I mean? But the Nazis
also
actually just...
I take back what I said about Hitler. He seems like kind of a bad guy.
Yeah, I've turned on him again.
Like, don't like that.
Yeah.
Don't fancy a scrap. But the Nazi officers actually described Wales in, like, specifically in the plan, saying, unlike the bright English, they are dark and small in stature. Even though they have largely abandoned their language, they have still retained a reasonable strong awareness of their distinct heritage and culture. So it was, I guess he's kind of nodding at the fact that we are different to England, although he calls us kind of, unlike the bright English, still having our own kind of culture. However, if they were to invade Britain and to win, they were to, the plans say that they were going to use a divide and conquer, divide and rule strategy. So they would have broken the UK into separate so-called independent states. So Wales, Scotland, Ireland would have been declared independent. England would have been split into different regions. However, similarly to what they did in France and Norway and Belgium, this probably would have just been a puppet state, you know, with a government that was, you know, linked to Nazi control. But it kind of maybe would have meant an independent Wales. So I don't know. I got this thought of, like, Hitler driving around with, like, a Yes Cymru badge in his car. You know what I mean? Like,
I was about to say, he's got the indie boys behind him. Like, they're absolutely full hilt on Insta going, look, he's not that bad, boys. Look, we'll get the country back. Why not?
Exactly. Well, one figurehead, it's kind of hard to know, but we do think that it could have actually been David Lloyd George, who would have been the figurehead of this Nazi puppet state, because he once met Hitler and spoke positively about him before the war. So, I mean, there's one theory, it could have been him. Who knows? He's also Welsh, by the way, David Lloyd George. Yeah. Not a good look. Mm. The two more quick bits. So erasing Welsh identity. So Welsh culture and language probably would have been erased. So the Nazi policy stated that only German, Italian, Spanish, French, Dutch or English would be permitted, declaring Wales, Welsh, a mere dialect. So they probably would have stomped it out to stamp out any kind of resistance.
And speaking bigger armies have tried, and it's still doing it. Hitler didn't stand a chance.
I was going to say,
absolutely. And speaking of resistance... Yeah. I know. I was with him with the indie Welsh stuff. It's like, wow, Hitler boy. Oh, never mind.
Right. I've been on the fence up until this moment, 2025. I've been on the fence, and now, what a wanker.
Just for the record, in case anyone clips that, I don't support Hitler in any shape or form. Just for the record. Okay?
Please don't take this out of context. Yeah. Also, the only people who are going to clip it are us as well. So, like, we're really sending you, like, blackmail now. Like, mate, we're going to need a couple of dollars for the night out tonight. Otherwise, this is going live. Like,
Yeah, Welsh S4C kids presenter and actor says, "Go on, Hitler boy!" Like, so like
denies all allegations, but of course that's what you would do. Yeah.
But speaking of the resistance and all that, they think that if they would have invaded and been successful in Britain, they would have actually stationed Nazi troops in Wales, but specifically in South Wales, because they believe that that's where was the strongest likelihood of things like revolution and uprisings and that kind of thing. However, they would have probably left places like Snowdonia largely unguarded. Which makes me kind of think, I'd love to make like a weird alternative history film. I've seen like Philip K. Dick, Man in the High Castle. Yeah,
Yeah. Class.
I would like to make, like a weird alternate history where they won the Battle of Britain and there was a resistance that was formed in Snowdonia or some shit.
Oh, I think mate, that sounds sick. Defending Snowdonia. Oh, yes.
We
please.
Did a, we had to do an episode at lunchtime today because we're a bit short on time. To do our episodes, and I researched one for this episode, but because we're only doing three, I thought I'd do it in advance, and I did it about the pockets of resistance if Operation Seal, is it called Operation Seal Bay?
That's
the
one you
mentioned. Sea Lion, yeah, where they built these auxiliary units across Wales, so Eryri in Snowdonia, in Banner Brycheiniog, in Brecon Beacon, Snabbergavenny, where they had these... because the idea was if the Germans were to land, it was going to be in West Wales. And they had these small units who didn't tell anybody. They didn't tell their family, their friends. People thought they were, what's the term you used?
Like draft dodgers. Like,
And Luke, what is your granddad? What was the word he used?
Conchies.
Conchies, yeah. So people thought they were conchies, but they actually trained with the best weapons, the best intelligence. They were like close quarter, like long quarter. They had snipers, they had heavy stuff. And their bases were bunkers in North Wales and in these mountains. And their whole purpose was to slow the advance of the Germans whilst the British army could recoup.
What?
And they weren't allowed to, and they had to fight till the absolute death. They weren't allowed to retreat. So I think if you were to make a film or something, you've got a bit of a... You could lean on a bit of actual history.
We discovered a film, didn't we, called Resistance. That we'd never heard of. And we were like, how have we not heard it? It's got like Michael Sheen, Ewan Rayon, Angela Riseborough.
Yeah,
was it in it? It was, what's his name from Uhtred, Son of Uhtred?
Oh, yeah, it's the guy who plays in The Last Kingdom. Who's
Alexander Drummond, is it? Drummond?
Yeah. Yeah.
But stat cast, and we'd never heard that. And it's not like they'll take the idea and make it like English, British, whatever. But it's actually set in Wales. Yeah. It's like the Welsh village and everything. So we've added it to the list. We've got to watch that.
Yeah. So, yeah.
What's it called, Resistance?
Yeah,
I think it's called Resistance. Yeah,
it's on Prime, so if you have Amazon Prime, it's on there. Sorry for interrupting. Back to you, Luke.
No, that was basically it. Yeah, that was those are the four things that was. What the Germans had planned, they would have made an independent Wales. They would have had mass arrests and forced labour. They would have erased Welsh identity, get rid of the language, and they also would have had Nazi troops in Wales, except for Snowdonia. But I know Winston Churchill said that if Britain had fallen, all that we have known and cared for will sink into the abyss of a new dark age. But at least Wales would be independent with Hitler. So, you know, swings around about.
They did say, there's that Irish saying, a country without a language is a country without a soul. So if Hitler did take it and give us independence, then what's the point if you can't speak a language?
Exactly.
Can I jump in, Jack? Yeah. Because my last one is about the role of Welsh national identity. So I think it would complement.
Yeah,
Luke's
go in something nice because I've got like a bloody
a battle.
Bit.
Cool. Yeah,
it's
with
a bit of a battle. Go on. You go. You go first.
Cool. So my one is the role of Welsh national identity during the Second World War. So not all the Welsh people saw British and Welsh identities as like compatible. So there's a small, there was a relatively small but really vocal bunch of Welsh nationalists who thought the British war efforts were destroying Welsh nationhood. Things like evacuees, introducing English mannerisms and English language into rural Wales, became quite a hot topic. Plaid Cymru opposed the war. They believed Wales should stay neutral, similarly to how they were in Ireland. Because, you know, Plaid Cymru see the British at the time, so the British state is just as dangerous to Wales as a foreign invader. The British Secret Services, they monitored Plaid Cymru throughout this. They put six out of... the MI5 had 156 potential traitors in Wales to be arrested, and six of them were members of Plaid Cymru. And their idea was they should be immediately arrested upon invasion. But the state was lenient. Yeah, I know, it's pretty mad, isn't it?
That's insane.
That state... today, all fucking 3.5 yard worth in chains being dragged away. I can't believe it.
Yeah. Although the state took a slightly more lenient view towards Welsh nationalism, because in 1944, when the regional commission in Cardiff reviewed complaints that the newspaper Banai Ac Amseru I Cymru was quite hostile to the war efforts, but it decided not to take action on the ground that the activities of the Welsh nationalists, though objectionable, were comparatively small. So they didn't want to make too much of a fuss of it, because then it might make it like make Welsh nationalism grow if they start saying, "Oh, look at this newspaper. Yeah. This paper is quite disparaging against the British or the English." So Welsh communities objected to the conscription of Welsh girls being forced into English factories and were horrified at the forced eviction of Welsh-speaking communities from Mynydd Eptin in Breconshire after the war. So in Banna Brycheiniog, they took people again from Welsh communities and took their land off them to put war offices in and things like that. The Welsh government recognised Welsh nationalism as valid grounds for conscientious objection. So if one of the reasons you could object would be, say, I believe in Welsh nationalism, so I don't want to be part of this.
Wow.
Although this was not always put into place, and they would still get arrested for it.
So that's our out, boys. Yeah. If it happens again. Look, I'm big indie ref, me, mate, so you can't send me over to Russia.
Of the 24 or so people who refused to be conscripted on Welsh nationalist grounds, around half of them still end up in prison and were fined. Although some nationalists, like Gwynfor Evans, he refused to serve on religious grounds and he was treated more leniently. But the war was like massively divisive for Cymru, because while some of the party wondered whether a German victory would be better for Wales, other supporters were really hostile to Nazism, especially because Wales is a very socialist country. They found, you know, the idea of Nazism incredibly vile.
Good stance to have, I reckon.
Yeah. Saunders Lewis, he had like alleged anti-Semitism and fascist sympathies, and he became a target for opponents of the party and was an embarrassment to some of the Plaid Cymru supporters. Although the war didn't damage individual senses of like Welsh identity, it did damage Welsh nationalism. So it's like a bit of a disparity between, you know, if anything, you felt a bit more Welsh because you were sick of so much British propaganda, but Welsh nationalism itself was in a bit of a rock and a hard place in terms of who it was meant to be supporting. During the war itself, Nazism was widely seen as evidence that all nationalism was dangerous. So Plaid Cymru, however, was right that the war did undermine traditional Welsh way of life, but it did centre the language and non-conformity. So there's 2 points there. So like during the war itself, like it happens now. If you say like, "Oh, I'm a Welsh nationalist," that, and if you said, "I'm an English nationalist," they sound like they're two very different things.
Nationalism, they've got such bad connotations these days. I think, haven't they? You know, like it's, but like you say a Welsh nationalist, that seems to mean a lot different.
I remember they used to try and get Nicola Sturgeon. They used to be like, "Oh, the SNP, isn't that just like the English? Isn't that just like the BNP?" And that was like a genuine journalist question, and she was like, "If you think we're the same, then you pig ignorant.
It has two out of three of the same letters, duh."
Yeah, so like nationalism in Wales is meant to be much more inclusive. Yeah, we won't get into that side of it, but they just try to think, "Oh, if you're nationalistic, you are dangerous." So then Plaid Cymru is not too sure how to deal with that. And also Plaid Cymru would deal with the fact that the war did a lot to undermine traditional Welsh ways of life, but it did also reinforced the Welsh language and non-conformity, because when those who were speaking Welsh were working within the army, they had a really tough time and were quite like ridiculed by English soldiers and often treated quite poorly. But it kind of further enveloped this non-conformity tradition.
It's a bit of a double-edged sword then, but yeah, I get what you mean.
And the last points about it was, whether they stayed in Wales or not, the war extended the Welsh people's horizons beyond Wales and its traditions. So it created a strong desire to build a better world where everyone had access to a job, healthcare, education, and stuff like that. So despite, because they'd been abroad, it kind of came back home with like horizons behind what might have been more closed-minded view of what was going on. It came back with a strong desire to be like, right, we've seen the hells out there. And then, you know, a couple of years later, and Aidan Bevan builds the NHS. Although I read this like quite biased BBC article, and it was like, "There were few who believed that Wales could achieve that on their own, no matter how proud of being Welsh they were." It's like, fuck off, you dickhead. just like, what, like, how do you know that's what was, I don't know. I just felt that was a very kind of BBC, like just saying opinion as fact. And then, yeah, well, last point then is the Welsh language saw a huge surge in support as people wanted to maintain a cultural identity amid English-dominated propaganda, and Welsh chapels played a huge role in morale-boosting, hosting community gatherings, concerts, fundraising, and promotion of the Welsh identity. So that's
You just need to ask. Just ask the prisoners in the POW camps in Wales. Yeah. We love a good sing song. It's great for morale.
Yeah.
I've heard the name Saunders Lewis before, though. Didn't he set fire to an RAF school or something in the late 30s?
Yeah, he's a troublemaker. Yeah, he's an absolute troublemaker. Yeah. He was like a politician poet.
He's that guy in school that had been sent out of the class quite often.
I don't know a huge amount, but I know he's quite like regarded by some as this great like bastion of Welsh culture. He was also a soldier, like he's a very famous soldier. He was a poet, and I think he might be involved with the Eisteddfod a big part of that. But yeah, he was a big writer as well.
You also mentioned he was a bit pally with the Nazis. So yeah,
a bit of
a blemish on the record.
But he's a Plaid Cymru person.
Lewis Valentine and DJ Lewis. So the three of them together, they set fire to an RAF bomber school that was in Wales, I think North Wales, in the late 30s. So they were kind of thinking that they were kind of militarizing and like forcing the want for war on the Welsh countryside. So they set fire to the school. To stop at the RAF from kind of training there. I'm sure Saunders Lewis was in that mix as well.
Yeah, he was. Although I'm just reading about him now.
It's a really cool story.
Well, definitely, we'll add that to this. Tan and Llyn, 1936. Apparently, half a million Welsh protesters were against his school. And yeah, well, we'll do that for another episode.
Yeah, I read about that, actually. I actually know tangentially about that. I know a tiny bit about that.
I think
not planning. Enough to say anything more now. Do you want my last bloody struggle to close us out?
Yes,
right? This is a good one, though. This is it ends on a good note, so don't worry. It's not too grim. So basically, as I mentioned before, it was kind of slim pickings after you guys got all the juicy ones, right? But I found essentially a modern day, well, fairly modern day, 20th century Welsh hero, right? From World War II. Basically a certified homegrown Welsh badass from the war. Mm. It was a guy named Tasker Watkins. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that name. But Tasker Watkins, he was born in Glamorgan. He moved over to Dagenham in East London when he was 13, became a teacher before the war broke out, and he was drafted into the Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry when the war started. He went into officer's training after about a year, earning the rank of second lieutenant. And then he was moved into the Welsh Regiment in May 1941. Not to be confused with the Welsh Fusiliers I mentioned earlier, though. It's the same spelling with a CH, but they're different. I think the Welsh Regiment, they take conscripts from South and West Wales, whereas the Welsh Fusiliers mainly took from North. Anyway, the reason Tasker Watkins is a badass is because on the 16th of August 1944, he was commanding a company from the Welsh Regiment in Northwest Europe with orders to attack objectives near the railway at a place called Before. In order to get there, Watkins's men had to cross an open cornfield, which they quickly found out was booby-trapped. Once the various explosives went off, killing quite a few men, they came under fire from a heavy machine gun and an 88mm gun from the same direction, essentially from a gun nest. Essentially,
pillbox.
Is that what they're called? Is that right? Killbox?
Pillbox, is it? Pit with a P?
Pillbox, maybe. Yeah, yeah. Basically, two guns, but you just nailing into them, basically shredding them up. Essentially, they lost a lot of men, and all of the officers in the unit were killed except for Watkins. Watkins led a charge with his men, and by some absolute miracle, he was firing with his Sten gun. Do you guys know what that is? It's like a little, it's almost like a little submachine gun, a little mini machine gun that they're like.
They look cool as fuck, don't they? They got like a handle coming out the side.
They do look cool as fuck. Yeah, they do really look cool.
It's basically a version of the MG42 kind of MG40, isn't it?
Oh, Luke, you're a big gun. I saw on your video.
Someone plays card, mate. Yeah.
No. Luke did a firearms training, didn't you? I saw that video of you the other day.
Oh, yes, I did as well, actually. Sorry, you're a real card boy, not like a fake card boy, I guess.
Yeah, not no Peter, not no fucking, what's his name? Pinocchio card guy. I'm a real cunt. Oh, yeah. But yeah.
I was wondering why you were going with that. That was good.
Do you know when you're like your brain thinks quicker than your mouth? I'm like, yeah. But yeah, I'm not going to go into too much. But it's a place in Glenheath called Firearms Training for film and TV, and you can like shoot guns and stuff. And I shot a Lee Enfield, which is a British rifle they used in the war. I didn't get to use a Sten gun, but yeah, I had firearms training for. So I can like handle firearms and be able to reload them, and it was like the best 3 days of my life. I loved it so much. I shot
the Lee Enfield, an action hero, man. It sounds sick.
Yeah, it was amazing. I loved it.
Aesthetically, the Lee Enfield is like my favorite looking gun. It just looks so like, I know all guns, you know, scary and dangerous and bad, but they just look so fucking cool. The Lee Enfield looks like a proper.
Yeah. They do look cool, don't they?
Yeah, I like that one.
Is that your favorite looking gun, Liam? He's also got a replica. It isn't fire, but he's got an AK-47. You can like reload. For me, that's my favorite. I think I know not favorite. Guns kill people.
Yeah, I know. It's weird to say, isn't it?
But just looking, isn't it? Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
No,
I've always been a fan of a Desert Eagle, only because I used to play. And again, I'm showing I've never handled like a proper gun, but. On Rainbow Six Vegas back in the day.
Yes,
and I used to do terrorists then. And me and my mate used to constantly go, we only do Desert Eagles.
Yeah. And that, was it me and you? And it really used to do that.
It might have been me and you, yeah. We used to do Desert Eagles. Yeah. I think I did it with our mate Sean as well. Yeah. And basically, those used to, they programmed it into the game that when people got shot with them, like they'd fucking ricochet off, like, you know, the bullet. It was sick. Anyway, we're getting off topic. Yes. But anyway.
Yeah,
the stuff we can do gun chat afterwards. But anyway, so it's the Sten gun. It's basically like a small automatic. How would you describe it, Luke? The gun aficionado amongst us.
Do you know I fired a gun as well? Actually, so I'm pretty cool.
Oh, sorry, mate. Okay,
thank you.
I don't know, mate. A submachine gun, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, just machine Google gun. It. There we Google go. It. It's
like a submachine. Yeah, Google it if you want. It looks cool.
Fully automatic submachine gun. Yeah.
Yeah,
there we go. That's what I wanted. I want the jargon.
Yeah, I wanted the jargon as well. That was good.
Yeah, I want you to be like, it does a 5.6 round, you know, 200 meters a second.
5.6. That's what I was hoping for.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so he, by some miracle, he just was absolutely spraying and praying with his Sten gun, and he killed both operators of guns, or injured them. In either way, they were incapacitated; they couldn't fire the guns anymore. Watkins was the first to reach the gun nest, and once he was there, he found another German soldier manning an anti-tank gun. His Sten gun jammed as he tried to shoot the German, so he lobbed it in the German's face, and then absolute quick draw, like bloody cowboy style, drew his pistol and absolutely popped him.
Jeez.
Put him down. Watkins now had only 30 men left, so all his men finally joined him at this like this gun nest. This, what do you call it? A pillbox?
Pillbox, yeah.
Pillbox. He had 30 men left at this pillbox, this gun nest, whatever it was called. And before they could catch their breath, 50 enemy infantry initiated a counterattack on their position. The lieutenant directed his men's fire, and then when they got close enough, he led a bayonet charge on the still firing Germans, and they killed every single one of them. They killed 50 Germans just with like close quarters stuff, which is brutal as hell. Orders had been issued to Watkins to withdraw, but the company's wireless set had been destroyed in the fighting, so he never got the orders. Him and his men, they were now surrounded by the enemy within like sort of kilometers. And they had depleted numbers, depleted ammunition, and the sun was starting to go down. The lieutenant decided to try and rejoin his battalion by passing around the flank of the enemy position. This move meant having to pass through another cornfield, something that seems to be a real fucking bad luck thing for Watkins, because as he did, they got fired upon by another German outpost. Watkins ordered all his men to scatter, and he charged the outpost solo, firing what was left of his Sten gun. He managed to get into their outpost, and he killed every single German soldier solo. And then he led the remnant of his company back to the battalion headquarters. Watkins left the army in 1944 after being severely wounded at the Battle of Den Bosch. He was awarded the Victoria Cross, one of only 39 Welshmen to ever receive the medal. He went on to have a career in law and rugby, and a quote he gave in 2001, he was like head of the rugby union. He wasn't playing.
He was like, law and rugby.
yeah.
Sorry.
I'll snap you in half on the field, and then I'll sue you for it as well.
That's fucking
sick of it. No, sorry, there's a bit of a snap back on there. He went to law, then went, you know, sod this, I'll be better on the pitch.
Yeah, he definitely went to law first and thought, fuck this.
Yeah, boy.
Fucking have it.
Sorry, I should mention he was in rugby, he was like administrative. So, like, he wasn't on the pitch. He was like head of the WRU for a while. But anyway. That's neither here nor there. Anyway, he gave a quote in 2001 that I thought was worth sharing. This is why it's fine talking about the last bloody engagement, because he says like a nice thing now. Mm-hmm. So, quote, "You must believe me when I say it was just another day in the life of a soldier. I did what needed doing to help colleagues and friends, just as others looked out for me during the fight in that summer. I didn't wake up the next day a better or braver person, just different. I'd seen more killing and death in 24 hours, indeed been part of that terrible process, than is right for anybody. From that point onwards, I have tried to take a more caring view of my fellow human beings. And that, of course, always includes your opponent, whether it be in war, sport, or just life generally." So that was Tasker Watkins, a man surely to be added to the long list of Welsh hard knocks. Oh, mate, can you imagine that? He's a hard bastard, is what he is. Absolute minerals on him.
Oh, it's a good one to finish on as well, because it does remind us that war is futile and hard. You know, don't make us go to war. Whoever's listening to this, just don't make us go.
Yeah. If anyone's thinking I wouldn't be able to perform such feats in a war. In fact, you know what? If you try and send me to war, you just try. I'll go camp out.
Yeah, I'll go to war with you if you try and send me. Well, we're a bit over time, but Luke, thank you so much for your time, mate. Where can people find you?
Ah, oh, nice, boys. Thank you very much. You can find me. I forgot my handles. Give me a second. Hang on. You get that.
Well, we'll put them all in the show notes as well, as we always do. So, and we'll tag you on all our social media stuff. But I can find your stuff if you haven't got it. You got it,
Luke Davis. You can find me on Instagram, Luke Davis Presents, and on TikTok on Luke Davis Presents as well. And yeah, my videos are all up on there.
Amazing. And yeah, your stuff's really great. It's really fun. It's really good for being a promotion of Wales. And you also get to look
listeners,
at a dish on
check
camera.
Check out Luke's stuff, because it is worth doing, honestly. Yeah. Jeez, and also, just to see his beautiful face as well. You can put it on mute if you want. It's still great to watch it.
Well, it's subtitles, like, so you check it out.
Well, exactly, yeah.
All right. Diolch yn fawr.
Enjoy that, boys. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that. Diolch yn fawr iawn.